You are listening to the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speakers Series podcast, featuring acknowledged experts sharing the current state, knowledge, and benefits of computer-related standards. This program is supported by the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speakers Bureau, a joint coordinated effort between the chapters and standards activities boards of the IEEE Computer Society. It's designed to bring advanced and current computing standards information to local chapters. Please visit www.computer.org to learn more about this program, membership with the IEEE Computer Society, and the wealth of current technical information, community services, and personalized services for the world's computing professionals. Now, here's part two of Joe DeCure, recorded on February 5th, 2007 in Vancouver, British Columbia, speaking on the subject, Ultra Wideband Update, IEEE 802.15.4a and ECMA-368.
So, in the 802 world, they have a subgroup called .15, which is Wireless Personal Area Networks, and they in turn have developed four major areas of standardization so far, and they're looking at a fifth. So, they codified parts of Bluetooth. They codified coexistence between Bluetooth and other things in the ISM band. They codified a high-rate wireless PAN. And they codified a low-rate wireless PAN. And the latter is used for industrial automation and what battery-powered things. And as of 3 years ago when I joined that group, they had several task groups. These were the most interesting to talk about here. They had task group 3A, whose job was come up with a new higher rate physical layer for this standard. They had a task group 3B to come up with a new high rate MAC, which was done. They have a task group which is still busy working on millimeter wave. That one will produce a radio short range and fast enough to deliver uncompressed high definition TV. They created 4A, which is going to come up with new physical layers for this standard. The ones I'm going to talk about today is this one and this one. Another one that they're busy on is mesh networking. So when you see an 802.15.5 standard, it'll be about how an array of things makes a mesh network. So this first standard, which was not ultra-wideband, was intended for multimedia delivery in living rooms, but at lower rates than are now achievable. It has a physical layer component, a MAC layer, a media access control component. Those of you who have studied communications theory and know about the open systems interconnect model, this classic seven-layer model, this is layer one and layer two. Layer seven is users, applications. So the original scope was to go at least 20 megabits per second, which was 20 times faster than Bluetooth of the day, but using the same band. The first ultra-wideband work was that task group 3A to extend that to substantially higher rates. That's where I joined this process, in this city in January 3 years ago. So in their model, they have a physical layer, a service access point for that physical layer. They have a media access control layer. They have frame convergence layers if you have multiple protocols sharing it. And they have in them what's called device management entities. I will not dwell on these today. But if you go off and read the references, these are things that you'll encounter. So, two different groups looked at ultra-wideband. TG3A, which I was primarily focused on, was looking for high data rates, 110 megabits per second and higher. They attracted contributions from two different ultra-wideband technologies, which is what I'll detail in subsequent slides. They struggled through years of deadlock before they broke up. Task group 4A also looked at ultra-wideband for the new physical layers, but their priorities were different. Instead of trying to deliver multimedia around the living room, they were trying to get lower cost per bit by going faster at the same transmit power, as per that chart that I went through. And they converged on direct sequence early. I'll talk about why. So the general idea for ultra-wideband is to have very low RF power, very wide bandwidths. In the United States, the FCC says ultra-wideband means 500 megahertz or wider. If you recall from those earlier charts, most of those radios were a much narrower band. And so the first ultra-wideband things that were happening in late last century, early this century, were strings of pulses. And the two kinds of proposals were of the first kind, direct sequence, essentially single carrier. And another one was based on orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, where you have hundreds of carriers. So if you can imagine looking at a very fast oscilloscope, and if you were to look at the signals you'd receiving, this is what the earliest ultra-wideband might look like. So you get a string of pulses. A pulse that's farther in one direction than another means perhaps a one or a plus, and a pulse in the other direction means a minus. Because of technical issues associated with receiving, typically you would not get one bit per pulse. You would use a block of pulses to represent a bit, maybe 6, 12, 24 of them. The data is just modulated by the direction, maybe the amplitude, and sometimes whether the pulse was there or not, and sometimes the pulse position. A modulation method that Fourier uses is that the space from this pulse will vary, and the variance gives you information. In the early phase, this study group looked at radio propagation. Whenever these groups do their work, the first thing they do is ask, well, what are the applications? If it does this well, how do we know when we're done? And then they come up with some kind of criteria to use to evaluate the proposals to meet those requirements. So they'll look at developing a mathematical model of the propagation channel. That's what these channel models are. And they came up with four of them. This was back in 2002. Dave Michelson, who was here, was part of that group back then. The key elements of that model is the excess delay. RMS means root mean squared delay spread. The number of multipath components, which I'll talk about in the next slides. The power decay profile. And they came up with four models. They went and measured radio propagation in a lot of different conditions. And they came up with four models to capture these ideas. And they're messy. CM1 means channel model 1. That was the easiest one, the most benign. Channel model 4 is the least benign, is the most challenging condition. A lot of absorption, a lot of reflection. So I think something... No, that's fine. I'm going to allude to that later. So back to the committee. A company called Parthasiva and Extreme Spectrum, which was later bought by Freescale, came in with a proposal. The Communications Research Lab of Japan came in with a similar proposal, and Oki Semiconductor came in with the third. And they all consolidated into something called the Ultra Wideband Forum, and they came up with a converged proposal. It had two bands, a lower one and a higher one. There'll be a picture on one of the subsequent slides. And each symbol is delivered as a series of those pulses. And you get different data rates by deciding how many pulses you allocate to each bit. If you're in adverse condition, you need to spend lots of pulses. If you're in a very optimal condition, you don't need to. So, and as the work progressed, they merged the proposals farther and they simplified some things. And in trying to solve the political deadlock, they came up with something called the common signaling mode, where one could conceivably have a radio that was OFDM that could be bilingual and also speak to a radio that was direct sequence, and they would be able to figure out which was which. For better or for worse, that proposal did not succeed. So they took two bands, 1 3/4 gigahertz. Imagine. I remember I was talking a few slides back about things that had a single megahertz of bandwidth or maybe 20 megahertz of bandwidth. This is 1,750 megahertz of bandwidth in the low band, or 3,500 megahertz in the upper band. Simple biphase modulation. Each symbol is a series of pulses, and I'll show you what those look like. Here's the frequency spectra. These are in gigahertz. Okay, if you remember from one of the earlier slides, ISM band is about where that line is, and the UNII band is here. And so they're picking this chunk for the low band and this chunk for the high band, and using the whole band when they're running. So these areas have different personalities. They're just at different advantages to using either one. We both have 50% fractional bandwidth, which is very high. In comparison, a Bluetooth radio with 1 megahertz of bandwidth is operating as 1 out of 2,483 megahertz. So that's 2,400 to 1. This is 3 to 1. So if you were to look at it on a very fast oscilloscope, you get a series of pulses that are either relatively positive or relatively negative. And so a symbol would be a series of pulses, a particular series of pulses. And to get different rates, as I said, in their proposal, there are 1,320 million pulses per second. This here is a pulse. Okay, band-limited pulse. So you can imagine that if you had perfect conditions, just pulse one way or pulse the other way, 1,320 million of them per second means 1.3 gigabits per second. How many of you have enjoyed using gigabit Ethernet? Show of hands. Ah, okay. Imagine that wireless. Too good to be true. In the close proximity, you're likely to get reflections, and you can't get near that fast. But it looks good in PowerPoint. So here they're in their proposal, here are the nominal data rates. If you use 24 pulses per symbol, and your forward error coding rate is half, that means you can deliver, and that means your symbol rate is, you divide 1,320 by 24, and you get 55. So that means you're delivering 55 million symbols per second, and if your coding rate is one half, then you deliver 27.5 megabits per second. And since you're using 24 pulses per bit, that's pretty robust, and you may actually get 29 to 30 meters. So as you see here, going to fewer and fewer code pulses per symbol and being more and more aggressive with the amount of forward error control, on paper, it scales from 28 to over a gigabit per second. I've never seen demonstrations of this technology higher than 110, but I have not been in an anechoic chamber with one either. Because reality is full of multipath, any radio signal can reflect. In fact, here in this room, my sound is reflecting around the room. Fortunately, the speed of sound is low enough that the wavelengths of the sound from my voice are much longer than the length of the room, so it doesn't get muddy. If these walls were acoustically hard, it would be a little tougher. And if we were broadcasting radio signals around and we had a room full of people who absorb microwaves or diffracted, and objects that reflected or diffracted, any pathway from me to some other station in the room would see not only the initial pulse, but many reflections of the pulse. And depending on the shape of the reflectors, the strength of those reflections might be higher than the strength of the line of sight. Or there might not be a line of sight. So if multiple copies of a signal arrive in phase, they reinforced. Focused antennas take advantage of that. If the multiple copies of the signal are out of phase, they mutually interfere. In the Task Group 3A world, we had four models. And those models had a lot more information than I'm going to try to present here. But one of the characteristics that they differed was that they approximated the number of multipath components that would be at least 10 dB of the line of sight, meaning large enough to have significant interference possibilities. And in their benign model, they expected there to be 12 different reflections. That's the benign case. In the difficult case, they expected 41. Imagine trying to listen to 41 people at once. So, this is a graph from that report. This is the impulse response. So, many of you have electrical engineering backgrounds and may have heard of the Dirac impulse functions and what they do. So imagine you try to excite the system with an impulse function, and this is time in nanoseconds. And this is the strength of the impulse response. That looks, to me, pretty messy. A really clean system would have one big pulse and not much else. That's busy. That's their benign channel model. And that's the challenging one. What this means is you have to, in a radio design, accommodate that. All your cell phones today have provisions for dealing with multipath in some way, depending on the nature of the radio technology. And here, this is stylized, but imagine you had a condition and you had a transmitter and a receiver, and here's a radio path and another radio path and another radio path. And the reason those are not 90-degree reflections is because the real world is full of reflectors that are all over the place. So imagine you had a red path and the blue path and the green path. So to compensate for that, you might have an antenna and a receiving amplifier, and you might have several delay lines whose delays are tuned adaptively to mirror image those differential delays so that when you get to the summer, they add up in phase. If they do, then you've effectively gotten yourself a larger antenna, and you have more signal strength to use rather than having mutual interference and having a worse condition. Anyway, that's what rake filters are for. Any questions about that before I proceed? I tried to make that as simple and comprehensible as I could. So, in the same committee, the rest of us were proposing multiband orthogonal frequency division multiplexing. In English, that means that instead of sending one carrier, you send very many carriers together at the same time. Like, imagine you've got a piano and you're dinging each of the keys in some fashion, and you've got something that's listening and can resolve each key. So you're delivering 88 bit streams at once. It's like that. So 15 companies contributed. They divide the band into many subbands of 528 megahertz each, and they use this technology, which is also used in 802.11g, so this thing does it. WiMAX does it. Those of you who have ADSL modems, they do OFDM. Home plug, when my wife and I were visiting a hotel in Nanaimo last fall, they said, we have internet access. Oh, that's nice. Where do I plug it in the room? They said, no, you come up to the front desk. They handed me a home plug gadget that plugs into the power line in the hotel room, has an Ethernet jack out, and it does OFDM. 802.11n has it, 802.20 has it, and all the plans that I've seen for fourth generation cellular use the same technology. A lot of them use it for the same reasons. So, those of you who've been to electrical engineering school, some of you know what a fast Fourier transform is, or an inverse fast Fourier transform. That's what these things are. It's not logically complicated. It's just busy to generate all those carriers and then recover those carriers. In fact, since the modulation is simple four-phase, basically, as you synthesize the carriers, you're just varying the amounts, the coefficients that you apply to the phase and quadrature components of each signal. So the modulation isn't hard. And because the symbol wavelength is 93 meters and the range is only 10, that means that all those multipaths applied to a sine wave just add up to a sine wave with slightly different phase. And since you're delivering pilot tones in the same burst with the modulated data, you can sync up the receivers and you capture all that multipath energy in parallel automatically. The data is encoded across all bands to exploit frequency diversity and robustness, and it degrades gracefully if you have to do a detect and avoid, which is several slides from here. And in particular, you can facilitate what the FCC calls a cognitive radio, one that can look at what the spectrum is, because it's already got an FFT, and determine what it can use and what it can't use adaptively. So conceptually, you can imagine on an oscilloscope taking a series of different frequencies and adding them all up. And this is the math, which I will not go through. But it does a symbol at 3.2 megasymbols per second. That's the inverse of this number of nanoseconds. 128 tones. Not all the tones are used for data. Like I say, some of them are used for just guard tones or for phasing, syncing up the receiver. And the tone spacing is 4.25 megahertz. Here's what it would look like on a spectrum analyzer. The way this design works, it uses sets of 1, 2, or 3 adjacent bands. If it's got more than one, it hops. I'll get to that in a moment. So you divide it up, and a given radio will talk to other radios in a band or band group. So here's band group 1, which is the easiest one to get to. In the initial specification that's published, this is the one that all radios have to conform to, and all these other bands are optional. As the regulators have gotten their hands on it, some of these may become optional. One of the advantages of going to an OFDM approach versus the direct sequence approach is that it's more complex. It's got at least twice as many transistors on paper, but it doesn't need the rake filters. When you add the rake filters, it becomes more of a wash. Meantime, it's almost all digital. Depending on how you build a rake filter, it's got a lot more analog parts. And those of you who may remember, if you take a chunk of silicon used for processing a signal, and you scale its area down, the noise figure goes up inversely with the square of, inversely with the area. So as we go to tighter and tighter chip geometries, digital scales down and analog does not. And as luck would have it, the regulators have shown a lot more interest in these bands than the original designers did. I'll talk more about the applications later. So this thing hops. And one of the reasons it hops is for frequency diversity. We kept the bandwidth relatively small, so at 528 megahertz, we can still build it on a CMOS today. But that means we're not occupying as much space in the spectrum as we could. And an advantage of that is the rules restrict your average power in each band. Let me step back for a moment. If a device is restricted to a single band, its power has to be minus 41 dBm per megahertz for all the time it's operating. If it's hopping from one to another to another and back again, the average power in any one of those bands has to be the same, but if it's spending only one-third of its time there, that means it can be 8 dB higher when it's there, and then 8 dB higher when it's there, and then 8 dB higher when it's there, and that gives it either more range or more performance, better signal-to-noise ratio. So it's a win to spread things out that way rather than have to be focused. So these radios, if you were to look at spectrum over time, they transmit in one band, hop to the next, hop to the next, hop to the next. The interval is about a third of a microsecond, because it's 3.2 megasymbols per second. Here's what the spectra working in a single looks like. They notch out the center so it's easy to track. And they can take that design and scale with the same FFT size, same modulation, basically change the coding. How many bits are data and how many bits are forward error control? from very conservative to pretty aggressive. The basic signaling rate in all cases is 302 megasymbols per second times 100 carriers, each modulated with four phase. So it's, that's wrong. That should be 2 bits per carrier. Gives 640 megabits per second. But so therefore, if you use a lot for forward air control, you get lower data rates, and if you use most of them for delivering data, you get higher data rates. Depends on your signal to noise, other performance issues. So laying these two models out side by side here in the committee from the slide we're engineering, these people were offering, with this frequency range, increasing data rates on very short or very long distances, 2 meters. And there were fewer choices here offering between 200 and 400 megabits per second. That's where the story was 2 years ago. Any questions? I like answering questions. Keeps people awake. So, after all these presentations and these choices, the committee had a decision to make. So let me focus on the technical contrasts. High performance direct sequence needs rake filters to capture that multi-path energy that I looked at. Remember those charts that I showed you with all those reflections? Compensating for that requires complexity and power consumption. And in contrast, the multiband design captures multipath energy with just the FFT DMOD process. But direct sequence is simpler hardware, has about half the gate count. If you have to add a lot of rake filters for high rates, it negates that, but for low data rate applications in the first place, then having half the number of parts, half the number of transistors means the chip is cheaper. And that's decisive for people who want, you know, a quarter of a megabit rather than 100 times higher, 1,000 times higher. At high rates, you get similar chip power. The direct sequence parts without the rake filters are still clocked at this rate. And the multiband parts, there's more transistors, but they're clocked much less than half the rate. And those of you who remember your electrical engineering know that if you take a CMOS logic part, the same geometry, and clock it twice as fast, it draws twice the power. Whereas the direct sequence design that Task Group 4A chose was clocked at 500 megahertz. So with half the transistors, no rake filters, and similar frequencies, this ultra-wideband radio would draw half the power that this one would draw. For them, it mattered. They're running on batteries. Other distinctions. If you have a fast Fourier transform and an inverse fast Fourier transform, it's very easy to sculpt your spectrum. It's very easy to turn off parts of your transmitter and then listen at the same time. If you want to build a radio that is listening for victim receivers. I have slides about that coming up later, because that's going to be the law in Europe and Japan and China. Leading to what's called the detect and avoid feature. To do the same things in the direct sequence radio would be much harder. You'd have to bolt that logic onto the front end. And the sharper it got, the more expensive it would be. The rules on detect and avoid were developed in the international community after the committee work was started. If that was not required anymore anywhere, the direct sequence radios would be attractive because they scale up to high data rates at very low distances. But if in most of the world they have to also do detect and avoid, it impairs them so much that they no longer are competitive. That's what that point was about. So for the low data rate ultra-wideband radio, 802.15.4a, they mitigate in a completely different way which is they use low duty cycle. European regulators allow you to run at low rates, and I'll address that further along. And they can also do simple detect and avoid by, in the granularity of 500 megahertz, say, do we have any energy detected? Oops, we can't use that band.
Thank you for listening to the IEEE Computer Society Standard Speaker Series podcast. If you would like additional information on the standards discussed in this program, or would like to learn more about membership with the IEEE Computer Society and the advanced technical information available, please visit www.computer.org. Some of the music provided is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.